Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The Square Ball Podcast.
Hello there. What's this then? A bonus episode of the Square Ball Podcast. And this one is ported over from the Extra Ball, isn't it? Hello, it's Dan here, by the way, and I'm joined by Michael.
All right.
So some weeks ago, we spoke to John Howe about Ellen Road, because the man has quite literally written the book.
A good book as well. Do buy it.
Yeah, and that one is out again now, the second edition of that, the updated edition, which reflects Bielsa being around and winning the EFL title and all that, and also a look ahead to the future of what the development of Ellen Road is going to look like. And in this one, though, we do get back into the history of it and some good moments in this, which I think you will enjoy. So enjoy this bonus podcast on the Square Ball feed.
And buy his book.
Of course, buy his book. It's available now. And I think he gives details in the recording of where you can get that. All good bookshops, I think, is the saying, isn't it?
And the squareball.net.
Yeah, if you want to get one signed by John, he will sign and personalise a copy for you. And I think he hand-delivers it in a tutu, doesn't he? Something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, COVID regulations, never mind that. Yeah. Well, enjoy our chat with John Howe. And we have with us John Howe, author of The Only Place For Us, An A to Z of Ellen Road.
Got it in one. Thank you.
The book's getting reprinted, reissued, an updated version for 2020. So we're going to talk about that today, because we thought, given that the 49ers have come on board recently with the extra shareholding in Leeds United, and rebuilding Ellen Road seems to be kind of right at the forefront of their ideas, we thought, what better way to approach this than to boot Moscow off the show and to get you on and talk about it, because you are the man who wrote the book.
Well, yeah, you've been down to do that for months, I can tell.
Moscow, we've had enough of Moscow prattling on about his book. He's sold that thing enough.
He's had his time.
First thing I want to do is start off with an apology on this show, because I texted you yesterday, and bearing in mind our studio is just off Ellen Road within the shadow of the ground, saying, do you know how to get here? And then it occurred to me this morning when I was on my way, it was like, he's coming in to talk about a book about the very area that you're on about. You
idiot. Well, the actual address is not a familiar address, I guess, but yeah, I know all the little nooks and crannies around this area, to be fair.
One of the big revelations for me is Islington. We're in Islington, a long since forgotten, disappeared area of Leeds that basically backed onto or even incorporated Ellen Road itself, if you are to look at the old Ordnance Survey maps. Mm. You know, echoes of Arsenal in this one.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people say that. It's odd because, I mean, until I researched the book, I didn't know that either. But probably late 19th century, I guess it was. There's a lot of migration of workers from London, and there's still an area called Little London in Leeds. And this was another similar enclave, I think. So it's called Islington, but it's pretty much disappeared off the map now. I think it's still used in planning purposes. There's a road sign. There's a photo of a road sign in the book where it's just down the gyratory, it's called Islington Junction or something. But other than that, there's nothing. So it's another little nugget of information that most people won't know.
So the book release date, it's slated for the 1st of March. It's the updated version for 2020. First one was done 5 years ago, so there's a lot to go at, new stuff in there. If you are listening to this before the 1st of March on the regular podcast feed and it's already out, it's because it got brought forward at the minute. But basically, you've got a lot of books that have been printed. Haulage is a bit of a challenge we gather in the UK.
Yeah, I think as far as I know, the books are like in a trailer somewhere in Dover, stuck behind some rotting fish or something like that. So when you get it, if it stinks faintly of mackerel, that's why. But hopefully, yeah, they're winging their way to the warehouse where the publisher is. So it's a bit of a fluid release date, but we're aiming on 1st of March, and we should be able to meet that, hopefully.
Well, my biggest testament to you, I think, with the book is that I sat down to flick through the preview of the updated version that you sent through to us, and I was going to just have a look. I thought I'll have half an hour just before bed just to catch up on what's changed, what it looks like, and I was still sat there at 1:30 in the morning completely engrossed in it. It's an absolutely brilliant read for any Leeds fans. Can definitely recommend you get your hands on it, which we are selling it on the Square Ball website. If you want to get it personalised, by the way, you can get it at thesquareball.net. And are we doing an All Good Bookshops plug?
Of course, All Good Websites, and probably not Amazon. Try and avoid that one if you want.
Unless you want to.
Yeah.
Because we've got no opinion on Amazon.
No.
Have we? No, back to the book. And it did two things for me. Number one, it made me really, really miss Elm Road when I was flicking through it, obviously. And the other one was that it made me a lot more at peace with the idea that the San Francisco 49ers are going to come in and demolish a load of it and rebuild it.
Mm.
How do you feel about that? Because we're doing this kind of around that time that the 49ers have come in and a big building project seems to be right in their wheelhouse. We've seen what they did with Levi's Stadium in California. And I mean, let's face it, Elm Road does need updating, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the first thing you think of when you hear that American owners are coming in or investment, you sort of worry that, you know, Americans are, you know, quite an imbalanced nation, shall we say. Is that fair? You know, 70 million people vote for Trump. But I think, and also the 49ers, I mean, they're on their third permanent stadium, I think, and they've only formed in 1944. You know, they've moved twice and are now based 50 miles away from San Francisco. So that's a little bit of a worry. But, you know, the thing that was quite reassuring this week, I think, was that Elland Road was central to how they sort of promoted this investment. And it was the first thing they were talking about in terms of developing what's already there and, you know, the training ground and this community hub that's been built on Fulton Park and things like that. So, yeah, I'm quite relaxed about how they're going to go about, you know, monetizing everything and moving us to the next level, because Radrizzani talks about the club needing a new skin. And you immediately worry about that because
we fear change in Yorkshire.
We fear change, and you know, the change that they've already tried to instill has not been particularly successful. But I know exactly what it means. But the worry is that, you know, at the moment I'm not quite said goodbye to the old Leeds. You know, I've still got unfinished business with Leeds United as it is. So you don't want to see it changing until we can get back and see it change, if you know what I mean. So. But I know exactly what they're talking about, and the fact that there's no suggestion whatsoever that, you know, a US franchise is going to come in and move as lock, stock and barrel somewhere else, that there's no suggestion of that. So, you know, you've got to be quite comfortable with it at the minute.
The stuff they have over there in the stadium, things like you can order food from your phone and stuff like that. I mean, imagine getting a meal deal to your seat, a pint and crisps or whatever it is.
Just if the barrels didn't run out before kickoff would be nice. You know, let's take it one step at a time.
One of the things that you love, Michael, that you've always said is how kind of piecemeal and thrown together Elland Road is. And that's one of the things that I've taken from the book is a lot of it's been done kind of on a wing and a prayer when you think about kind of, you know, bloody the porter cabins that are the South Stand executive boxes, the foundations for the southeast corner that sat there for what, 20 years or something daft like that.
Yeah.
That it is kind of all cobbled together. The uneven roofs, like in the northeastern.
I was just going to mention
northwest
that.
Corner is brilliant. I love it.
Both corner stands don't match the cop roof, even though they were built afterwards. You know, it was like the perfect opportunity just to join it all up and make it all sinuous and nice. But they didn't for whatever reason. I love that. And I don't suppose we'll ever see that in a redeveloped stadium, unfortunately.
That's the thing we're likely to see, just a sweeping roof line that all makes sense and is beautiful to the eye. And is that what we want Elland Road to be, attractive?
Make it deliberately bad. I've said this before. Yeah. Make it look uneven.
There's
I'm
a
sure
way of
they
doing
won't.
It.
I wonder with the West End when they redo it. I'm not quite sure where they should go on that architecturally. I'd kind of like to see a bit of a throwback to how it looked, the original pre-banqueting suite version. If they could make it have some sort of echoes of that with the old signage and everything,
yeah.
I think it'd be quite a nice touch, but I dare say we'll get some glass and
I think they
chrome.
Will do that because the corporate side of it will be incorporated into the stand rather than just joined onto the back like a stick of Lego like it is at the minute. So, yeah, they could probably do that, although I don't suppose there'll be space to sort of walk behind the back of it as you can now, but... but yeah, the facade would be nice to see back, that sort of regal entrance that we
had.
Yeah,
I mentioned that to Angus Kinnear when we spoke to him a little while ago. I said, could you maybe do a nod to the blue entrance? Because that's another thing I ended up really lamenting when I was looking through the book, because there's photos in the book of the blue facade being constructed, which I absolutely adored, because to me it was always a relic, but to see it kind of being built and, you know, Bricky's putting up the turnstiles on the west stand, it makes your heart leap in that nostalgic way.
Yeah, and it's all still there, the windows. You know, I've mentioned this quite a lot to people when we talk about Elland Road, just for the fact that I'm watching the Tottenham Amazon documentary at the moment, and you look at their stadium and it's £1 billion and everything, and you compare it to ours and we've still got single paned windows that have been there since at least 1970 in the corner where I sit, but the rest of the West End, you know, since the 1950s, and I don't think there'll be any other stadium probably in the top two tiers that have got that kind of feature. And it's just wonderful.
The northeast corner from the outside is one of my favourite bits of Elland Road, where you can see people having pints through the window as you go up to it. I don't know why, I always really like that bit.
It's got that concrete sort of brutalist 70s architecture to it, which is just very Leeds in terms of the city as well.
So would you say that I think of Elland Road in the same way I think of the Evening Post building, which has obviously since gone, in that I kind of acknowledge they're both fairly ugly, but I also didn't want either of them to go. Like, I quite liked the Evening Post as much as it was. Yeah. I mainly drove past it and went, "Christ, that's an eyesore." But when they got rid of it, I was like, "Oh, don't get rid of it. That's the Evening Post. You've got to keep that."
I didn't mean that. It's like that. People lamented the Lowfield stand, and when the East Stand was built, and that's not 27 years ago. And but you know, if that Lowfield that was still there now, we'd be an absolute laughing stock. You know, it looked bad enough then, but
I mean, I remember going in it as a kid. I won't say toddler, but I think I was definitely under five. And one of my earliest memories is running up and down the back of that stand, because they built, like, the food outlet was at the back, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just so dark and like satanic right at the back there. But it's funny how I've retained that, because it felt old then. So I can't imagine what it would be like now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, unfortunately, you've got to move on, and I think people understand that. And we've had a lot of time to enjoy the West End and find peace with it moving on. And I think, you know, various regimes have talked about it over the years, and it's been dying a slow death, really. So I think it's time to move on with the West End. I don't know really what the plans is I see the northwest corners, though. Don't quite know where that fits into, whether they'd sort of extend that as well. They probably would do, although I don't suppose you can do that until you build the coppers. But
I've got a feeling on that what they'll do is they'll start with the west, but with a view to it joining on the south and the northwest corner. Yeah, I think they'll do the lot. So even if we don't get that joined up sense immediately, you might get a new bit that stops before they redevelop the cop. But you get the sense, the way that they were talking in the press conference anyway, when they announced the extra shares being purchased, was a new stadium. It's not just some new stands, it's a new stadium. So my conclusion from that, just a personal one, might be wrong, is that they're going to do the lot, probably. Maybe leave the East Stand, but I wouldn't be surprised to see the lot come down overall over a course of a number of years.
Yeah.
Build one, move the capacity over there, and then keep going, kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll have to be piecemeal, like the modern stadium is, you know, that was developed over 15 years with a big gap in the middle and that kind of thing. So there's no other way of doing it, but it's like whether that's conducive to maximising income at the same time. And the Premier League don't like, it's all about the visual product with the Premier League, you know, so they won't want a building site as their sort of global image, if you know what I mean. So that might come into it, but I don't know how else you could do it.
I mean, flicking through the book last night, one of the things that, I think I knew this, but it was being reminded in the book, that the West Stand, it finished before it got to the northwest corner, and they had to extend it that way because obviously when the pitch moved 18 metres over the course of a few years towards the new cop in the 70s, it's 74 it was built, the new cop, I've lost track of the
68
the sorry
cop,
so they gradually moved the pitch up over the course of like three seasons, wasn't it, 9 metres and then another 9 metres, and then suddenly you've got this gap at the end of the old West Stand. So even the West Stand that we see there, the original West Stand, is not all the original West Stand. There's the extension as well.
It's like the original West Stand had the tunnel directly in the middle, but now it's almost in the goal mouth. There's a South Stand, so that shows it quite clearly. But about a third of it is relatively new.
In that it's not 1957 or whatever. Yeah.
As old as me, basically.
And that's the thing, you know, when they build the new West Stand, which is inevitably going to be the one that goes first because they want the corporate. I mean, let's follow the money on this one. It's going to be the corporate, isn't it? Do you want the tunnel on halfway, or do you want it slightly wonky?
Keep it wonky. Keep the away fans not looking at the pitch. That's what I say.
Yeah.
But you get to pay top price to look at the south stand.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's another thing I was thinking the other day, because if you go to Anfield, for example, that new stand is virtually all corporate, and I don't think there'll be many paying fans going into our new west stand. It'll be mainly corporate and you know, package deals for one day trippers and that kind of thing. But what do you do with the away fans? I think you'll still have to stick the away fans in there, because they're building a new tunnel to enclose from the. There's going to be a coach park on Fulham Park, and so it's like an easy access for away fans. So it sounds like away fans are going to be permanently or semi-permanently in the west stand for now. So that doesn't quite fit in with the sort of corporate image of this new stand. But I think you're right. They'll build more boxes in the west stand, and you can maybe take the boxes out of the south stand, so that becomes bigger. That might be all the space they need in the south stand for now. It's hard to say.
I was going to say, off the top of your head, can you remember what the original capacity of the south stand was? I did note this down last night, but I've since
forgotten. About 7,000, I think. 4,000 upstairs, 3,000 downstairs.
It's a big stand, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's been terracing for a couple of periods as well. But yeah, it was this, without the boxes in it. There's a good photo in the book, actually, of it originally without, before the boxes went in, and it's a decent size, you know.
Yeah, it looks grand. It makes me nostalgic.
Yeah.
Just on the away fans, is Elland Road usual in the way it's moved away fans around over the time? It feels like normally there's a more set away end at ground, whereas it feels like they've been in the low fields in the south, in the cheese wedge in the west. It feels like we've kind of dotted them about over the years.
I think there's various other, I'm trying to think of other examples in the away grounds. I mean, Everton used to be behind the goal, and now it's on the side. Villa also was like that. So probably not, but yeah, I know what you mean. It's been a bit nomadic at Elland Road because they had the cheese wedge. And
where should they go?
I think to answer that question is probably related to the 3,000 stipulation of the Premier League, isn't it? So now it's a proportion of capacity up to 3,000, whichever is lower, isn't it? So you're never going to get more than 3,000. So as long as you've got a dedicated 3,000 area for seats, then that's where they're going to stay these days, I think.
Yeah. I don't like them being in the West Stand, I must admit, but I think it probably is the best place.
Maybe we stick them in a new southwest corner or something like that, because that's one area of the ground I've never seen a stand, and that'll blow my mind when that finally happens.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. But again, the West Stand, we were just talking earlier about, you know, that end of the West Stand, you've got a better view of United Fisheries or Gravely, should I say, than the match itself, you know. So I'm not sure if that'll ever be able to change that bit.
Mind you, it's been so bad over the last 15 years, pre-Bielsa at times, that you could just sit there and gaze off and imagine you were somewhere else, couldn't you?
This was a big thing about when I was asked to write the book or rewrite the book. I sort of read through it for the first time in 6 years, and the main thing I needed to change was just to make it less downbeat, because it was written in sort of 2013-14, which is like the sort of arse end of the GFH Chileno kind of era, and it's like
you were cashing in on the feel good factor, weren't you,
exactly,
in those days?
Yeah, and almost every section was just depicting this really miserable existence, and you know, Elland Road not being a nice place to be, and reading it in 2020, you know, didn't reflect how it currently is, you know. So I had to not just rewrite things factually, but rewrite the sort of experience to sort of reflect how it is now, to be honest.
Yeah, I think you've done a really good job with that. I think you've got it right on the money. I was saying to you before we started recording that I think there are nice sprinklings and nods to 2020 and what's happened in the last couple of years, even right up to the talk of the redevelopment of the West Stand. I think you've done a really good job with that. It's just really nicely executed.
Yeah, I mean, the cover, changing the cover was a bit of a bone of contention, because I didn't really want to do it. I mean, it's the old cover, the original cover is a classic photo, but I was never quite happy with how it looked. You know, the four floodlights from a distance.
It's at night, isn't it? So it's a black cover with like this glowing thing.
Yeah,
in the middle,
so it doesn't look quite as spectacular as it should do. So I wanted to sort of change that, and I thought, well, let's have a bit more of a contemporary cover, which cynically does appeal to you know, a younger generation of Leeds fans who maybe newer, we don't know. But it's more of a sort of an up-to-date cover to make it a bit more, less of a nostalgia trip, if you like. But, you know, the content of the book has still got plenty of nostalgia in it. So.
It's strange with the update how one of the updated pictures is this sort of dystopian Jack Harrison celebrating in front of some cardboard cutouts. Yeah, it's weird to think back to when you did the first one, that would, if someone could have shown you that image from the future, you'd have been thoroughly confused by it.
Yeah, exactly.
You?
Yeah, like, I mean, that's why you know, just writing about promotion wouldn't necessarily make sense, but I had to write about promotion as a completely unique way of doing it in front of empty stands and with cardboard cutouts, because that'll hopefully never happen at Elland Road again. And so it had to feature in the book from that that standpoint, really. So yeah, I wanted to get a photo of the crowdies. I nearly had one of Alioski clapping the crowdies, but I went for that. I went for that one of Jack Harrison because it was just quite a funny picture, really.
Let's talk floodlights then, because actually, as you know, Sod's Law would have it, they've put up £1.5 million worth of floodlights since this photo was taken that's on the cover, which doesn't have them in, but there's a beautiful sort of dual quality to the lights all facing the camera. So you're going to have to send a photographer before this hits the shops, or for the third edition with the new floodlights. Mind you, we'll have a new West Stand by then, won't we, when the third edition.
Yeah, I mean, I actually just managed to get a photo of the new floodlights in because I had a deadline, I forget when it was, end of October or something. And I knew the new diamond floodlights were coming, but I didn't know when. And there was a delay with it. So I referenced it in the text because I knew what they were going to have. They were going to look like diamond floodlights and stuff. But they actually fitted them in the week before my deadline. So I thought, well, I've got to get a photo. So I went down and took a photo. And the designer who was doing the layout of the book was like, bloody hell, you know, I've changed the layout at the last minute kind of thing. But I did manage to get a photo, which was quite important.
Speaking of the floodlights, again, going through the book, I found that the fourth floodlight, that the one that went in the southeast corner, went in last. Didn't really need it, did we?
No.
It was because the other three were so bloody bright that it covered off all the lighting requirements, but it was done mainly for like aesthetic reasons.
Yeah, I think, I mean, again, it would, you know, I'm obviously too young to remember it as three floodlights, but another inelegant element of Elland Road is they had three floodlights rather than four for, I think, 4 years. But yeah, they were spectacular for the time, but obviously they wouldn't be any good now. I think you'd have to upgrade them anyway.
So. When did the fourth one go in? It was quite late, wasn't it?
78.
Yeah, 78, yeah. Yeah, it was later than you realise.
They were obviously trying to develop that southeast corner at the time in 73 when they went in, but they ran out of money, so they just thought, oh, we'll just put the fourth one up. And that corner didn't get developed until 91, and they built the southeast corner, so the cheese wedge.
If you could bring back one old element of Elland Road, would it be the floodlights? If you could sort of transport in a piece from history?
Possibly, yeah. Either that or the facade, the West End facade that we were just talking about. Possibly, yeah, it's a toss-up.
Difficult, isn't it?
I never even saw the big floodlights. I was a family stand man when the magnificent new East Stand came along. That was my first experience of Elland Road, so they were gone by the time I arrived. So.
It was one of those things you could, you know, I make a joke in the book about sat-navs. You know, you knew where you were in Leeds when you saw it. You could see them from any sort of angle in Leeds, anywhere you were. You thought, picture, you can work out where you are.
I mean, cause for me as a kid, one of the big thrills was always if we came in on the motorway, was to drop down the M621, and when you first see them, it's almost like when you were a kid going to Blackpool and you saw Blackpool Tower. Yeah. I've seen it. And, you know, there's a competition in the car for whoever saw it first. Similar sort of thing with the floodlights at Elland Road, just having your heart leap as you head down the hill.
Yeah.
And now they're gone, but you still see Elland Road, of course.
Still a glow, yeah. I mean, I live quite close to the ground, so I see the glow of the floodlights, and it's quite nice. So.
One other thing that I really, really liked discovering in the book was, people might be aware, might not be, but there is a well under the pitch in the northwest corner, so just outside the penalty area, and there are some great comedy photos of the groundsman, was it in the 80s or 90s, up to his sort of chest height stood in this well. It gives you a sort of idea of where the top of this well head is. It's maybe about 4 or 5 feet under the pitch. But it's a big old thing. It's maybe what, 5-6 feet across this well. It's a proper brick structure that goes down right into the ground. And that's a relic of the pits that were around Elland Road.
Yeah.
So there were, as it says in the book, functioning pits sort of. So if you're aware of where the railway line is, near Fullerton Park, a lot of that was coal pits, wasn't it? There and right around the ground. And
it was also rhubarb fields for a long time. There were various pits dotted about. I mean, you can't imagine it now because it's all completely developed.
And then these wells, was the water to serve the pits? That's where they drew the water from the ground, wasn't it? A lot of it. And when they moved the pitch in the 20s to orientate it the way that it is now, 90 degrees, it meant that one of the wells there that was originally behind on the north side of the ground, off the pitch, was actually then under it.
Yeah, and I think it actually got covered up by the cop when they built the original cop, and then they when they excavated that to build the current cop, it sort of, they discovered this well, and I think they did use it to walk the pitch for a time. John Reynolds, the original groundsman, he used to use it, but they don't use it anymore, but they've still got access to it.
Yeah, they're saying that the water was too cold, wasn't it? And it kind of killed all the grass. But is it Keel Barrett, who's the current groundsman, who's saying they've got tanks under the south stand? Again, another thing I never knew, tanks under the south stand where they store all the water.
Yeah.
And they can pump this stuff, go flick a switch at the side of the west stand next to the pitch, and it'll pump a load of water into these tanks. Because they still got access to it, but don't use it because it is clean enough to drink. They tested it, didn't they? They said it's clean enough to drink.
I think you need to get a license, like the Environment Agency, you need to get a license to abstract water from it or something. And whether they've still got that license, I don't know. But yeah, technically, I don't think the water is usable, basically.
And there is a story, an apocryphal story of somebody falling down. Because at one point, I think the photo in the book that you've got shows the well being uncovered when they're doing some work on the ground. And it was just like three metal bars over the top of this thing. And like a wooden, essentially like a wooden platform that was resting on top of these bars just to cap it off. Almost like, oh, that'll do. And you know, wood obviously rots under soil, and when water goes through it. And there was an apocryphal tale that I'd heard of somebody actually falling into that, you know, during a game at one point, a leg going down into it.
There's a picture of Paul Reaney peering over it into it. But yeah, you can imagine that, you know, Don Revie might have sent some people down there as a punishment at some point. But,
but the other thing about the well, when reading about, there's a whole section on wells. It comes under W because it's an A to Z.
It's a fairly short section.
I was drawn straight to it because I love this. This is what I like about Elland Road. It's the little quirks and the foibles of the place. There's a second well. That was the big revelation for me. There is a second well which currently resides somewhere under the south stand.
Yeah, well, I've never. I mean, it's disputed whether there is or not. I mean, I think I put that in the book. It's not, some people say there is and some people say there isn't, but I don't know where it is. And I asked the groundsman about that, and he said, "Well, I have no idea." But you know, it's one of these things that might have been covered up by the south stand when they built that kind of thing. But it would make sense because you know that area was, you know, well used for mining.
I just love the idea that we've got all this history under our feet, and I think that's what probably makes me lament the changing of Elland Road. It's all rooted in nostalgia, and I made this point to Phil Hay when we recorded with him recently, saying, "I think I'm reluctant to see Elland Road developed because so much of my childhood is still there in the stadium as we see it today."
Yeah,
even accepting the building of the, you know, the magnificent new East Stand. Which I, again, like you, Michael, I, you know, sat in for years as when it was like the family stand. It feels like so much of my like formative years have been spent in there between, so you know, 88 to 92, which was incredible, and then you know, rolling forward to seeing like people like Yeboah, and then the Champions League era, and it's not been so great since until recently. But even then, you know, you look back to it's your teenage years, your childhood, and you go. Yeah. It was magical, and so much of what I see when I step into Elland Road, I think it's because it takes me back.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that sort of motivated me to do it, you know, a few years ago in the first place was looking at old photos and discovering what Elland Road looked like when I first went. You know, my first game was in 1978, and there used to be a cricket ground next to the pitch on Lowfields Road, which I think by then was like council football pitches before they built the industrial units that are there now. And I kind of imagined, bloody hell, I had no idea that was there then. And, you know, the car parks on Wesley Street, the bottom of Wesley Street, there was housing right up to those corners. And I found some photos of that.
I love those photos.
And I was like, that's what it looked like when I first went. And I think, you know, I wanted to capture that in sort of words and pictures. And I thought, well, everyone's got those, their own memories of whenever they started going. And it's important to sort of capture that. And hopefully the book sort of does that for everybody in terms of, everyone's first game is a unique and precious thing to them. And there's something in the book that captures that for them in terms of that's how it used to look and that's how it used to feel. And it kind of becomes personal then for everybody. And hopefully that comes across.
Do you think the snapshot of Elland Road on your first visits are always the version you prefer?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, I'd love to capture the excitement of those first few games. I used to go about once or twice a season at the time. And it was really exciting, and now it becomes not a chore anymore, but it becomes routine.
It was for a long time. Let's be honest.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm trying not to say that, but it became routine and every day, and you get too familiar with it. And yeah, I'd love to bottle that and be able to experience that again. And this is maybe the only way you can do that. Really.
Yeah, I did. I love those photos. There's the one that you're referring to is taken from the west stand facing towards the southeast corner, the cheese wedge, before it was built. And it's just glancing through that gap and seeing the houses coming right down to Elland Road. And because I think of Elland Road and probably throughout most of my lifetime, I've always kind of viewed it as a sort of a symbol of, I don't know, post-industrial decay, when you saw like the old haulage firm behind the cop just basically laying in rack and ruin for years. And now obviously we've got the park and ride, and seeing the West Stand as a relic of a bygone era. To me, West Stand equals John Charles because of, you know, selling him to basically part fund it. And then the car parks around Wesley Street, just this open expanse of kind of, it's almost scrubland, isn't it? And seeing, I don't know, just so much of it just reminds me of kind of decay and things falling apart. And I think that's one of the things we're going to have to get our heads around as they develop it, is that it's going to look a little bit shinier and a little bit newer. Like, it still jars a little bit seeing the photos of the park and ride, because it's been hard landscaped. And I thought, oh, looks all right, that. It's fine. But I think it's really nice to capture that, because that's one of the things that taking those houses down, I mean, a lot of them slums, the ones that came right down to the edge of Elland Road, or were they kind of knocked down for the purposes of progress?
Yeah, I think a lot of them will have been empty for a few years, to be honest, because it's the movement of people takes time, you know, and building council houses elsewhere or whatever only happens over maybe a decade or so. But so I think a lot of them were empty for a long time and then demolished because they were inhabitable.
And that was another erosion, I guess, of the community of Islington, which was there, which is now, it's no longer a thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's quite a lot of social history. I mean, in the book sort of tells a story about how populations evolve and how communities evolve. And, you know, the building of the M621 just completely obliterated so much housing and completely changed the identity of the area. And I don't think there's been another example of that in Leeds, really. And it all happened within a few yards of a major football ground, you know, and it's just quite amazing.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Really? I think that one of the things I found really stark was that there's a photo in there of Lowfields Road, which was built just to serve as a link road between Gelded Road at the top, where the garages and whatnot are now, and then Elland Road itself slightly further south. It was built for the purposes of the football ground. And some wonderful photos of all the trams just lining up there to serve the football crowds. And it almost looked like a Roman boulevard is what I want to say. And it's made me almost like lament the chance to have that. Imagine having 100 statues down there of all our greats, kind of thing. And that's where they do the parades and stuff. And then in the middle, you've got this big, bloody great brutalist M621. But then again, it's given us the tunnel.
Yeah, exactly. Michael's tunnel. Wouldn't be without that, would we?
That's again, one of those things, I guess, about your first visits to Elland Road. Because if you went to Elland Road before the M621, you probably hate that tunnel. But because it was there when I first went to games, and my dad used to work for Yorkshire Electricity, so we used to park there, and that's kind of up on Gelded Road. So we used to always walk down to the ground that way, and used to buy square ball in that tunnel. And it was as much part of the day as any of it, I think. And I think that's why I like the northeast corner, because that's where I arrived at the ground, and you'd sort of see that on the way to the family stand. And I don't know, it was like, it was all part of the stuff you would see. It's like I said about being able to see the people drinking in the corner, also seeing people sat overlooking the motorway with a pint from the wagon and horses. Weirdly, that was like part of, I don't know, sort of like part of the atmosphere building and the excitement of a match day, and just feeling like there's something happening.
You know, it's like when you go to away games, that every ground has got a feature which you kind of remember, and sometimes it feels a bit sinister as you're going as an away fan. And I've always thought the underpass under the M621 is that, because you go under and it's suddenly murky and it's echoey.
That's because I've got my man reputation, I suppose.
Yeah,
that's part of
it. Yeah. Troll under the bridge, can't you?
Yeah.
What you did capture really well about the tunnel, I really liked, is not just referring to the tiles, but the sound under there, because it's got quite a low roof. You can just jump up and touch it, you know, if you're of a, at least a moderate height. I know you probably couldn't, Michael, but, you know, John's taller.
You'd probably catch something, though, because it's full of damp.
But being stood there many years selling the magazine, kids always try and touch the roof. It's one of those brilliant things.
It's a rite of passage.
It's an instinctive thing to try and jump up and touch it. And there's like, you get like 7-year-olds doing it. They're obviously about a meter away from doing it, but they still try. It still looks low enough that
one
thing.
Day.
And yeah, that.
Exactly. That day will come when they're a gawky teenager.
Maybe not for me.
But they'll be able to do it. But how it sounds under there as well. And that's one of the things that made me really like kind of lament the fact that we haven't been for a year. Was that it was a reminder of that. It's that really visceral experience. Because to me, my childhood involved parking somewhere like around Latchmore Road and around one of those, and then just walking around the corner and then there's the two burger vans. So for me, the smell of frying onions reminds me of Elland Road, which is beautiful. And then, you know, stinking sweat and lager and all that kind of thing. But yeah, it's the frying onions and then it's passing under the M621 and hearing that, just that change in tone of conversations that you captured really, really well.
It's kind of like when you're going into the ground, you're in the outside, but that tunnel is like the conduit to the match day experience. So you go from outside to inside, if you know what I mean. So when you come out of the tunnel in Elland Road, there, it's like, right, this is it.
It's like crossing the Rubicon, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And on the way out, you know, you can hear everyone's conversations, and you come out, and suddenly it's like you're back in the outside world, you know. And it's like, well, what should we do tonight? So.
Well, do you think we will we'll feel nostalgic when we walk through that tunnel and we see a rebuilt COP that's no doubt going to be bigger than the existing structure, walking through there and seeing a more refined concrete, glass, chrome, whatever it might be, structure, will it still make your heart leap in the same way? Because I draw parallels with Newcastle, and their fans are really proud of their stadium and the fact that it dominates the skyline, and that's got the wonky quality to it. And they've got a real attachment to even the new build. Do you think we'll feel the same about Elland Road when, you know, the northeast goes and the COP goes and the northwest?
If they do a good job of it, and if we're successful, I think that's the two things that the two will always go hand in hand. It's like kits. There's obviously a good kits and bad kits by sort of stylistic standards, but then a kit that you win in is always going to be one that is remembered well. Mm. A kit that you've finished 15th in, as good as it can be, you're never going to probably get retro replicas of that produced because no one's asked about it.
Yeah, it's like the extension on the back of the East End, you know, slated at the time because it was diverting money in the wrong way, you know. But if we built that now, for example, you'd think, oh, that's a great idea, you know.
Apart from the cladding. Still not keen on the colour.
I've got issues with the colour, yeah, but... Yeah.
Why was it done in that colour? Were you able to get to the bottom of that? I can only guess cheap.
Yeah, it was cheaper. Yeah. It was cheaper than grey or white.
Yeah,
because
it's
a grey and blue stand with some cream on it. Yeah. It just seems a very...
Faintly beige, yeah. I don't know. That's a good question.
What do you want a new COP to look like? Because it's important, symbolically, what they do with that stand.
You'd say a single tier, wouldn't you? You'd definitely want it single tier.
Like Spurs have done. I mean, it wouldn't be the same scale, I imagine. But even still, you know, you've got enough of a footprint behind it that you could build backwards there, couldn't you?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to stand sort of pitch level and look at the COP. It's not actually that big. You know, it's not that intimidating at all until you get people in it, obviously. So it's not that impressive, but I think you could do it single tier. Yeah, I'd like to see that at the very least.
It's just a big sweeping thing that's like that. Well, like I guess like Liverpool's, for want of a better comparison.
You just want one body of people. You don't want to see it all broken up by gangways and stuff.
There's a possibility we might be allowed safe standing in it by the time they come to redo it as well, which would be a nice... I think that'd be a nice thing to do there.
It's an important conversation that I think actually that needs to be had, isn't it? And where we are in terms of that legislation, because, you know, a lot of people stand anyway.
Everyone stands. I mean, I've been in the COP for 15 years now, and I don't think I've ever sat down, apart from maybe the odd League Cup match where there's been like 7,000 people in the whole stadium, and you're like, oh, Christ, they just think I'm just going to sit down for 10 minutes. But you sit down at half time is what happens in the COP.
Yeah,
and then the rest of the time, everyone is stood. So it just makes sense to put it in if they can, if they're allowed. There's no reason not to, really, with the way it is now. It's no one suggesting going back to the old days of open terracing and the odd barrier here and there. It's still essentially allocated seating, isn't it, with the way it works?
There's a bit of a lull in that kind of process at the moment because obviously no one's in grounds. But I think Man United had talked about doing it, haven't they?
Mm-hmm.
And Spurs, possibly. So it would only need one of those two to do it, and everyone will do it.
So. Mm. Just going over to the other side of the ground, then opposite the Kop, let's go to South Stand and Scratching Shed. And I really enjoyed just, you know, going through the imagery of turnstiles going from street straight into the back of the stand in the Scratching Shed. It's just a nice image that there's just not that buffer. There's no facilities. It's like, that's the street, that's the ground, and that's the wall between the two, and that's the lots, that's everything. What do we do with the South Stand in terms of redevelopment? Because we saw that, you know, the pitch got moved 18 metres towards the Kop end to be able to balance the two stands out, but as it's transpired, that's not quite enough. I mean, we'll get a lot of capacity from a rebuilt West. Do you think they'll do the South as well?
I'm not sure you could do it to the same level, could you? Unless you went across the road. Someone mentioned that, like Atletico Madrid used to have a stand that went over, bridged over a road, and the road went underneath the stand.
It's even a motorway, isn't it? I think it is.
But they've moved stadiums now. They're not there now. So there's a few planning issues with that, I imagine.
And block all the light from people behind as well, aren't you? That's the thing. If you've got a football stadium looming over your back garden, you might not be
But the housing doesn't actually come that close at that point, does it? It's more businesses, the houses. There's only sort of four houses that are right on the road.
It would have an effect, though. I mean, there's houses behind the Peacock, and they're not that far away. So it might have an effect on that. But
the one behind Subway and stuff as well, there's all those houses on those streets just by there.
So you might end up with like a Lansdowne Road effect where one of the stands is a lot smaller than the other. I mean, but like you say,
City Ground as well is a bit like that.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't mind that. I'd be fine with that because that would give it a little bit of a quirk. Even if they had a uniform roof all the way around and it just gave a little bit of variation, I'd be up for that. I don't know about you.
Because like you say, I'm not sure they could do the Kop. If they do the West and the East together, same height, I'm not sure they could do the Kop as high as that. So you wouldn't need to do the South as high as that either, but it's hard to say, really.
I wonder if we'd see sort of angular ends to, so maybe the West Stand almost becomes like the Northwest upper, if you like, you know, like it extends around in the way, you know, where the Spurs new stadium kind of abuts up to that single tier stand.
Yeah.
And it's kind of just an angled extension almost of the upper tier. I wonder if we'd see something like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, like we said earlier, would you want to see it all one level and all nice and,
Nah. Keep the South as a bit quirky.
It needs to have a bit of a peg leg in a way, doesn't it? You know, and it needs to be sort of pitched up and irregular and, you know.
A white wall all the way around the pitch. That's what I want.
Yeah.
That's another thing that I've taken out of the book. That's mentioned, isn't it? That was sort of a retaining wall. It's one of those unique features of Elland Road that I've always been aware that it's there, but I've never paid that much attention to it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, obviously there's a lot of YouTube videos being watched and, it's how I worked out what the there used to be a shelf in the middle of the low fields, like a really odd
view. I always wondered about that.
Yeah, and I never worked out myself, but I realised that it wasn't supposed to be there. It was because they built a wall halfway round to develop the top of the low fields to match the corners, but it never happened like that. So it wasn't supposed to be there. But yeah, there's various features over the years which, you know, you don't really notice they're there, and then you realise why they're there, and it's difficult to know how much detail to go into.
Oh, but that shelf, I mean, I've lost hours reading about that shelf now in your book. I'm flicking through, I'm trying to find more detail about it just to understand what it was, because it always used to mystify me as a kid, and for the benefit of anybody who's wondering what the hell we're talking about. So the back of the old Lowfields Terrace had a white wall that extended into the northeast and the southeast corners, which was built later to create a uniform bowl so they could then develop backwards behind that wall. But there'd also been a wall built towards the front of the old Lowfield stand.
Yep.
So there was kind of this nether region in between of maybe what a few ended up as a few rows of seats and terracing, bit of a death trap really.
Yeah.
So there's kind of just, it was just like a little, almost like letterbox shaped thing at the front of the old Lowfield stand that was kind of neither up nor down.
Yeah. Perfectly described, to be honest. Yeah. And it was another beautiful quirk. And there's some great photos over the years of that, of people stood in it or sat in it. There was a little gangway in front of it as well, which I remember being in myself, and it was literally a death trap, you know, in the days where no one was that bothered about how many people you could fit into a very small space.
And then off the side of that stand as well, another little beautiful thing, again, because it's pointed out in the book, it's not something I'd ever been aware of until you'd written about it, was recounting the stories of having the Lowfields upper stand and the glass ends to it. And then terraces behind it. So people used to have to kind of peer through the glass to see the see the ground, and obviously, you know, they're not going up there cleaning the windows every week, are they?
Yeah.
So you're kind of having to look through the grime if you happen to be in the corner behind the glass.
I always loved a feature of Ellen Road I loved was the grass banks on either side of the old low fields. And it was, I think it was the only ground I can ever think of that's got grass anywhere other than on the pitch.
Yeah.
In clear view. I mean, for years it was the first thing you saw on TV, because you know the TV cameras were facing that way, and it was just two grass hills in the middle of a stand.
Yeah, because they just capped off the ends of the old one side on the cop end, the terracing, and then obviously the low field stand got chopped off when they moved it all over towards the cop, and there's just the grass banks, which again reminds me of childhood. And yeah, I never thought about it in the context that you don't ever see grass hills inside football stadiums in it's relatively modern
unusual,
era.
Yeah.
You just made me think, actually, if they redevelop the West, we might see Ellen Road on TV from a different angle for a while, which will completely throw me.
I can't
imagine it being filmed from the East as a permanent solution.
The only time I can think that they did that was that Sampdoria game in the Makita tournament when they were building the East Stand. For some reason, they put the cameras in there. But when the season started, they put them back in the West. So, yeah, that would be very disorientating.
Maybe were they upgrading the gantry or something like that?
Maybe.
Because that was one thing when we've been watching some of the games for the Match Ball 30 that we do from 1990 and 1991. Some of the camera angles are slightly off-centre. They're just maybe slightly over towards the tunnel instead of bang on the halfway line, which I found quite jarring when I noticed it. So it has happened. It's just that we tend not to notice it.
Mm. And the gantry is apparently a feature that's quite well renowned within the game, because there's very few grounds where you get that kind of viewpoint. And it is, if anyone's ever lucky enough to get up there, it's an incredible way to watch a game. But in terms of media facilities, there's not many grounds that have got that kind of thing, literally in the roof of the stand.
Is that right?
Yeah. Adam Pope mentioned it a few times, and Tom Kirwan have said that, you know, people come here just to sit on the gantry, because it's, you know, in some grounds, you just sat in a pokey little seat in the middle of everyone else, you know.
Oh, right. I never realised it was so unique in that fashion.
Yeah, apparently, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously our own Moscow would, if he was here, we'd be ringing the gantry gong bell, because we mentioned the gantry, because he's managed to get up there. But yeah, he's always said, to be fair, it gives you a really good viewpoint. But no, I'd never realised it was that unique in that sense. And there's obviously the slightly frightening experience of getting up there on a ladder.
So yeah,
in the olden days.
Yeah, I mean, you're literally banging your head on the rafters, and there's bits of flaky metal come down.
Some lead paint.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, there was asbestos in that roof for a long time. Wasn't
there?
Don't
have to talk about that. But yeah, it's. I mean, you go up there, and there's wires upon wires, and they haven't ripped stuff out over the years. They've just put stuff on top of it. And I was lucky enough to go up during the making of this book. I had a quick tour. And just to see the kind of new facilities they've got, and that, you know, there are some new facilities, but there's a lot of the old facilities just sort of, you just ignore that kind of thing. You know?
Don't look at that. Come over here.
There's a lot of that, so, which is great.
When the 49ers did their share purchase recently, Parag Marate, who's now the vice president, whatever it is, of Leeds United, he spoke of retaining the soul of Ellen Road as they redevelop it. How do they do that? And we spoke about the blue facade. What else can they do? Tough one, isn't it?
Yeah.
How do you do it with a brand new concrete structure that will have much better leg room? I mean, because part of the charm of Ellen Road is getting your shins destroyed when there's a goal goes in, or complaining about the East Stand Lower.
I mean,
the East Stand Lower has still got the original concrete from the Lowfields terrace, hasn't it?
Yeah, the seats on the East Stand, for cup games, I've relocated there, and the seats in the bottom bit where the terracing used to be, you've actually got more leg room there than you have further up. The legroom further up is,
well, that's where my seat is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thankfully, I'm of long of back and short of leg, so and I'm at the end of a row, so it's all right. So I can kind of just drag my leg out into the gangway a little bit and trip people up. But
my seat in the northwest corner is wooden, which is probably again unique in the Premier League, I'd imagine. So I'm quite attached to my wooden seat, so they could do stuff like that. But yeah, it's difficult. I mean, you know, the catering is still pretty 1980s, isn't it? So they could maybe retain some of that. But
I remember for years they still sold burgers in the football in the Yorkshire Rose bags.
Yeah.
And we'd had the new crest for about 10 years by this point, and you could still get a burger in the old one, and you thought, Jesus Christ,
where has that been sat?
They must have had like a million of these sat in the catacombs of the East Stand and they're still trying to drag him up every week.
How many times has this been cooked?
And whatever's in the making of the bags that's been outlawed since. But yeah, so how did they do it then? What's the essence of Elland Road that we need to capture and to keep as this gets redeveloped?
People talk about the acoustics and depends where you sit in the ground, but certainly when you sit in the West Stand, the acoustics come in from all sides. Seems to be fairly unique at Elland Road in terms of the bowl that's been created. So you need to retain the acoustics somehow. But how you do that in a bigger stadium?
You can do it with angling the roofs down and stuff, can't you?
Yeah, ways you can do it, I'm sure.
But isn't it more than that? Isn't it something more? Don't you need something more tangible, something to look at? But again, this is what I don't quite get. This is the circle we've got to square is retaining. What do we retain? What's the thing that we need to capture?
I think what I like about the Kop, which you're lacking a lot of modern ground, is that it feels really tight, and it's because they've adapted an old stadium for seating, but it feels like you're right. There's not much leg room, and you're really close up to the people next to you, to the extent where, like, if you happen to be sat next to some fairly big people, you're just completely squashed. And
your knees are together.
Yeah, but I think that is part of what I like about it. When I've been to Arsenal, you score a goal and you don't naturally kind of fall into anyone's arms because there's loads of room around you, and you've got about a metre to the seat in front, and it just feels a bit like you're celebrating in a little bubble. Yeah. I quite like it at Elland Road that there's a bit of a surge when you know a goal's about to go in, and then when it does, there's a natural grabbing and piling on of people, which I know in these times is an odd thing to want, but I do miss that.
You want to come home with grazes on your shins, don't you, and bruises a couple of days later.
Which I think is very difficult probably to explain to an American investor.
Yeah.
But no, I like that bit.
You don't want it to be like a visit to the theatre, do you? You don't really want comfort. You want functionality, really. You want it to retain that. So, yeah, I don't mind being a bit uncomfortable at the football.
Someone says you can have a hot dog in your seat. It's like, yeah, but what I really want is a sweaty man dropping on my head. That's what we've scored.
Because that's what the experience is all about. Yeah, yeah. And I guess you tapped into that when you wrote the bit in the book about lamenting the old stairways at the back of the Kop that led... But it's where the Kop bars are now, aren't they? They've capped the stairs off, and it's where the upstairs level one Kop bars are. But there used to be, when it was terracing, an exit/entrance, back left, back right, to allow people to get out. Because you've got the famous, is it four white ones across the middle at the minute? And then you had two, one in each corner at the back. And I remember as a kid going down those, and it's that thrilling sensation of your feet not touching the ground that you mention in the book, which, again, terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. When you look back on it as an adult, and the health and safety implications, and we now know how unsafe grounds were with these massive terraces, that stick a stairway in there, that'll be fine. It's a crazy thought, isn't it, that you lament the loss of the dangerous things.
Yeah. When we talk about, you know, you want an element of danger at a ground, we're not talking about flouting health and safety laws or anything like that, you know, or creating a death trap. There's always an element of intrigue and you know, it was a bit of an escape basically from everyday life, and you want it to be like that. You don't want a nice armchair to sit in, you want a wooden seat.
But if ever there was a side of the ground to stick a big roomy, I don't know, more sterile environment, it's the west side, isn't it, because that's the more sedate stand on Elland Road. So
I'm fine with that. You know, like I said earlier, I don't think there'll be many paying customers in the West Stand as in terms of regular fans when it's eventually finished, apart from if they keep away fans in there. So yeah, keep that separate. But the rest of Elland Road needs to be quite uncomfortable and intimidating. You know?
I think there can be something for everyone. That's the thing. I remember when Bates changed the pricing in the family stand, some people moved to the Kop, and I think that changed the nature of the Kop slightly, because you ended up with people in there who actually kind of wanted to be sat in the East Stand, but they didn't want to pay the East Stand price. And
we moved to the northeast corner for that reason.
And it changed the fabric of the ground. And I think if you can know that, yes, you can go over there and you can sit, and you can go over here and you can stand, and you can go over there and you can stand and make a lot of noise. It's just, if there's something for everyone, people find their place in a ground. And I guess that's when something's redeveloped, maybe that's where you struggle in a new stadium, particularly one that's more like a bowl, so there's not distinct ends to it, is where you fit within that.
Yeah. I think that they should be able to still retain that. I mean, the Kop, if say that is a single tier, much bigger stand, that will still be the popular end for that type of person to that type of fan to sit.
Yeah, that was my next question.
And the South Stand would be as well, you know.
What sort of a realignment, and when I say realignment, I don't mean physically moving it, but I was going to ask, where do we see the supporters gravitating towards? Because suddenly, if you have that, do you think it might pull something away from the South Stand and make that less vocal?
I don't think so.
The South Stand's developed its own identity in recent years. Like, if it's been 10 years ago, I probably want to be in the South Stand, but now I go to games and I generally drive because we're doing this and I've got magazines and stuff. So I think I'm too sober to go in the South Stand looking at it. And the cop's about right for me because it's like, I want to be able to sing and I want it to be raucous, but I'm not quite drunk enough to be...
I mean, I'm not always sober enough to have that, but I'm quite happy to sit down nowadays and just watch it from a different viewpoint. But yeah, hats off to the people who started the South Stand movement, because at a vital time, it really sort of kept people together and it sort of built up and now we've got a period of success. So.
And you think how we went from the South Stand being closed to what it is now, and I don't know, the time of that being shut and the East Stand Up were being shut, I just think of them as really, like, it was probably the most depressing time at Elland Road when it felt like we were shrinking the fan base to the extent that we were just going, well, we don't need that anymore. And it felt like, what's the logical conclusion of this? Are we all going to be in the cop at some point? And they're just going to go, well, the rest of it, we're going to put a hotel there because it's probably more profitable.
It goes to show the importance of the football team. And that's what always got me about Ken Bates, was that he never seemed to care enough about the football. It was always doing just about enough. But look at how far down our attendance is eroded with what was crap football, or at least a crap level, even if the football itself was good. We were, League One level, getting charged ridiculous prices, paying through the nose to sit through an experience which wasn't a great deal of fun versus what we've seen now, at the opposite end of the scale, and the demand that sees 20,000 people on a season ticket waiting list, plus, that's on top of the 23,500 we've got now. I mean, imagine Leeds having, 45,000 season ticket holders, 45,000, because traditionally we've never been a massively supported club, but that's kind of at the root of what everyone says when they say we don't need a stadium that big, but actually we probably do. Mm. The modern Premier League era, that's the way that things are going.
Yeah, I mean, people say, in the middle of our last Premier League tenure, if you like, we weren't selling out every week, but I think the product is different now, and the way the Premier League is sold now is different. It's more global. There will be people, if we've got capacity, there will be people coming from all over the world on day trips to visit Elland Road. I mean, there are now anyway, but there'll be more, so maybe, I don't know if 60,000 is maybe pushing it a little bit, but, I think you would sell out every week at 50,000.
Yeah.
You look at other grounds from that era as well. Old Trafford was about half the size it is now. Newcastle's massively expanded. Arsenal have obviously moved and added 20,000. Spurs have it's kind of doubled theirs.
West Ham have got the capacity now. Shit stadium, but
Yeah, but the demand overall has obviously increased from that period, because no one was selling out that consistently, were they, in the mid-90s?
But what I do like about what they said this week is that they're talking about, we're going to wait 2 or 3 years to become established. So we know that we need that demand. We need to fill that demand, And the 49ers are saying the same thing. We want to build a legacy that's going to last 20, 30, 40 years, then it'd be easy to say, well, let's just build a big stand now, but we don't need it now. We need it in a couple of years. So they're still being quite measured and basing on Leicester City and this kind of thing. So it's fairly sensible.
The idea of Premier League tourists when the world gets back to normal coming in, I actually quite like it. A lot of people hate the idea of Premier League tourists, but I like it. I like to think that Leeds United as an experience is enticing enough to make people want to come. And I imagine if they were to come now, they'd go, oh.
There's a certain romance in thinking it's the people who've always been there. But as we were saying, like, I was in the ground with a shut South Stand and a shut East Upper, and it wasn't fun, was it?
No.
They were shit times, let's be honest, because the atmosphere was, at worst, it was poisonous, because everyone in there was pissed off at having to be in there. And the state of it all. So when things were going badly, it was not fun. No. And occasionally you got games where you had a little reminder of how good it could be. But the best times at Elland Road are when it's full.
Yeah, it's like when they did ticket promotions where you could bring a friend or something. I could never get rid of them. You could never get anyone to come. You just didn't want to.
Which friend do you hate most?
Yeah, exactly. So why would I want to do that?
Where would you put the tourists then? In a new built West Stand maybe? Get them in there?
Yeah, I think that's...
90 quid a head?
Yeah.
Keep it cheap for the rest of us?
That's what Liverpool do. Yeah, if it's good enough for them, let's do it.
Yeah, why not set your sights high?
I think the 20,000 waiting list is, you need to look after those people first, but it shows that there is demand, but that demand can quite quickly disappear, depending on how we're doing.
So. And that's actually the thing that that encourages me, and it's what you just referred to there, John, with what the 49ers have said, they're going to wait a couple of years to make sure the demand is there. That encourages me that they understand the value of having a good team. And we've seen, you know, in the demonstration of what they've done in the transfer market last summer by spending 100 million quid and financially exposing the club to a certain extent, that they're prepared to do that. And they understand that it has to be a good football team that takes to Elland Road. Otherwise, the rest of it is pointless.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it'd be very easy for them to come in and say, we're going to be the next Man City, you know, and Leeds, all jokes aside, have got that kind of potential, really. But they're looking at a more sustainable model of, you know, building it a bit more gradually. And it must be very frustrating at the moment because a lot of the 49ers have been on board since, what, 2018? 2.5 years, something like that. And they're still sort of talking about an informal arrangement where they're sort of lending expertise. But so there must be a lot of plans they've been talking about, which they just can't put into fruition because A, we didn't have the finances in the Championship, and B, now we haven't got any kind of corporate income at all. So I'd imagine as soon as fans come back in, we will see a lot of change in terms of hospitality and that kind of.
Question for you both then about a redeveloped Elland Road. Put yourself in this position. So let's assume they do rebuild west, northwest corner, round to the Kop, round to the northeast corner. John, you're in the northeast corner on your wooden seat.
Northwest. Yeah.
Would you sit there in the new stand, in the new configuration, or would you look to move?
I would probably try and stay where I am. I do like the angle of where we watch the games. But yeah, I wouldn't want to sit in the west stand if it's going the way we've been talking about. I wouldn't want to be included in that group of fans. But I think I would probably stay where I am, even if it's plastic.
What about you?
Yeah, I'd stay the same. Unless they somehow made the Kop more, they took the opportunity to develop it and make it somehow more corporate and put a line of boxes in or something, and it changed the vibe of it, then I might move south stand. But I don't see any reason to move.
I don't think the demographics of people in each stand would change that much.
You know, because that was the question that I was making, referring to with Michael, is like, would we see this kind of shifting of people? Because you'd have to see some, wouldn't you? Because there's going to be people in the rest of Elland Road who go, fancy a bit of that, that looks nice. Because, you know, we kind of like the grubby shin bashers parts of the ground. But there's going to be people who are attracted to the new, you know, leg room and plenty of space and cheese bar or whatever.
I feel like it's kind of a nice bit about supporting a team who's graduating from one bit of the ground to the other as well. Because I used to, as you did, Dan, used to be in the family stand. And I used to always look at the Kop and think, oh, it looks great in there. Because it was good. I used to like the family stand because I was obviously a child and with my dad and stuff. And that was, and it was kind of, it was a really good spot to watch the game from because it was actually far more so than the Kop. It was actually a good view of the pitch.
Mm.
But I used to look at the Kop and think, yeah, fancy a bit of that. And now as I approach 40, I look at a bit like John, I look to the corners and think, could fancy a bit of that.
Close to the Kop, but I can sit down.
There'll be a seat next to me for you, Michael, at some point. But yeah, I was exactly the same because I had a great season ticket in the Kop all the way through the Champions League years and then into League One as well. And I thought, when I got that, I thought, well, I'm never going to sit anywhere else. This is fantastic. But you do sort of move on. And I really like where I am now. So, but I don't think I'll gravitate into the West End, to be honest.
Get that blanket for your legs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, take a flask for half time and that kind of stuff. But no, I can't see that happening.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how it all does develop. And you can chart the history of Elland Road in The Only Place for Us, an A to Z of Elland Road, written by John Howe. New edition comes out on 1st of March 2021, or before that, if you're hearing this before that, because this is going to be time to come out with the relaunch of the book. So fingers crossed they get it distributed for you soon. And like I said, I spent hours on it last night. It's a fantastic read, and it made me feel nostalgic and optimistic and hopeful. And it was very, very entertaining. So nice work on the book.
Thank you.
You can get your signed copy from thesquareball.net. We're selling copies of the updated version on there. And check it out in bookshops. The Only Place for Us, The A to Z of Elland Road by John Howe. Get it now. And thanks for listening to this. We'll catch up with you in a bit.
The Square Ball Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes
without the ads.
Did you know that Xavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball? It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult, and that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.